Hey everybody, Doug here. Just wanted to give you guys a heads up on the interview that you're about to listen to. I welcome my guest, Abby Schrack, up on the front porch this week. And Abby is a very soft-spoken person, and this comes through in her microphone. So I just wanted to give you fair warning that you might be playing with the volume knob a little bit on this episode. I cranked her voice up as loud as I could, and it was still a little quiet. So these things happen, right? It's an organic show. So sit back, grab the volume knob on whatever device you're listening to, and enjoy this great conversation with my dear friend, Abby Schrack. Singing Dutchman Productions. Hello and welcome to Doug's Front Porch, a podcast where I get to sit down with friends old and new and have honest conversations. Today I welcome Abby Schrack to the front porch, a friend that I got to know through work, and now we don't work together anymore, but we've maintained a great friendship, and I'm so happy to have you on the front porch. Welcome, Abby.
Thanks, Doug. It's good to be here.
You got me out of bed early. We are both, and this will come out in the conversation, we're both farm kids, so waking up early is not a big deal, but this is, on the record, the earliest recorded episode of this show. The sun is just coming over the mountain here, looking out my window, so, but I got an extra cup of coffee next to me, so we're going to be all right. Abby, I always have everybody start kind of the same way. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up, and tell us one or two things about your childhood. Did you have brothers or sisters? And I know that what you're going to say is going to lead our direction a little bit way later on.
Okay. Yeah. So I grew up here on a farm in Paradise Valley, Pennsylvania, close to Turbotville. And I have a little sister. Grew up here with my two parents. My parents both worked off the farm, but we also operated a grain farm, while growing up. And yeah, we got to try lots of different things. And it's pretty neat growing up on a farm because it's really a lifestyle. It's not just a house and then not just a job. So it's been fun.
So growing up, you had this farm. Do you have animals on the farm?
So I'm back on the farm now, and we do have animals, but not the same animals that we had growing up. Growing up, we kind of transitioned. We started out with no animals, and then we got horses and chickens. And then eventually my parents got sheep. And so today we have Shetland sheep with a few Icelandics, and we have ducks. We'll probably get back into chickens in the next couple of years here too.
Growing up as a kid on a farm with animals and all of the work that comes with that, how did that experience as a child shape you into the person that you are today?
Oh my gosh, so many ways. So we think of farm animals as like working animals and not as pets. A lot of people want to cuddle a lot of the animals, and we're always like, no, they have a job. You know, they're supposed to be eating the grass right now or eating the bugs and giving us eggs. And also, you know, the responsibility of taking care of those animals and really stewarding them and the resources that we have is really important. And I think that those are things that, you know, someone looking in from the outside wouldn't see on a farm. They would see it as, oh, you give them food and they give you eggs, but they don't see the inner working relationship between the animals and the land and the people and all of those things and how they work together.
So were you, how old were you when you were out there, you know, feeding animals and watering them? Were you a really young little girl, or was it something that happened a little bit? Did your parents wait to put you to work?
We were always doing it with our parents. I don't remember when it transitioned to I was doing it and not my parents doing it. Yeah, we always did it together.
Yeah, I had the same experience until the point that I could do it on my own. Then my dad was like, okay, go get the eggs, or okay, go feed the chickens.
Yeah. And now, you know, we just moved here within the last month or two. And so this was like an introduction to caring for animals for my kids. But now my oldest is 8 and she wants to take care of the animals by herself. She says, let me go by myself. She enjoys it.
Yeah, it's I wish every kid had the opportunity to, even if they don't grow up on a farm, just to spend like a week in their childhood on a farm to understand. Well, you learn so much. I mean, not only where your food comes from, but, you know, the value of work and, you know, responsibilities and a lot of things that you said, too, like teaching that all of these things work together. It's the farmer, it's the animal, it's the land. It's not like they're not three separate entities. They work in a relationship. And I think a lot of people that have zero background in agriculture, I think, totally don't understand that concept. And it's such a rich and strong concept to really wrap your head around. So
yeah, it's its own biome, really.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay, so we'll fast forward a little bit. You go to high school, and then you decide to go to college, and you studied at Lycoming, and you were correct me if I'm wrong, you were a Spanish major, correct?
No, actually, I was a history major. I took a semester of Spanish, but my degree is in history.
But you did study abroad, correct?
I did not. I graduated from Lycoming in 3 years, and then I felt like I had that extra year that I could have used for school, and so at that point, I went and lived in Venezuela.
I knew you were in Venezuela for a while, but I didn't know if that was through Lycoming or so. Was that something? How'd that work out that you just was like, well, okay, I'm going to go to Venezuela? Or did you have a connection down there? Or how did that ever come about?
Well, yeah, good question. So thinking back, my faith is really central to my life. And so it was in college as well. And at the time, I wasn't thinking about being a missionary, but my sister and I both went to Lycoming, and we got involved with, it was called Campus Crusade for Christ at the time. It's now called CRU. And it wasn't on our campus, but it was another local college campus. And so we were going to their meetings. We went to their annual big event that they have in Washington, D.C. And I started hearing about this opportunity to go abroad, and I had wanted to study abroad, and it just wasn't working with my college schedule and how I needed to earn my credits. And so I thought, okay, well, I need to go to an English-speaking country because I speak English and I don't really know another language. I had some Spanish, but not fluency. And then there was only one opportunity to go to an English-speaking country. But I went instead and heard at that room, like I wanted to go in and hear more about that, but that room was like packed and I couldn't get in the doorway to even hear about what it would be like to go and live in that English speaking country. So I ended up in the Venezuela room and, you know, just heard about the opportunity for the first time and things really clicked for me. And I thought, wow, I could really see myself doing that. And it was really like God moved in my heart. I don't think I would have chosen something as challenging as what I got into, but things just really fell into place for me to go there.
So you just mentioned that you didn't think it'd be something as challenging. So what was challenging about that experience?
Oh, you know, I went in with the very American idea of, well, I already know the language and I have the right answers, you know, white savior complex. And I very quickly learned that Pennsylvania Dutch Spanish does not cut it. They did not even understand the Spanish words I thought I was speaking and asked me to speak their language because they didn't understand my English. So I had to close my mouth for about, you know, the first 6 months and really do a lot of listening.
So that was true immersion language learning at its best. How quickly did you, you said you closed your mouth for 6 months. Of course, that's not necessarily true, but how quickly did you realize, or what was the moment when you finally realized that light bulb moment? You're like, hey, they understand me. Do you remember that moment?
Not in particular, but I do remember it was about 3 months into my time there that I started dreaming in Spanish.
Oh.
And that was the moment that I was really like, this language is clicking with me. And yeah, definitely by 6 months I was fluent, if not bilingual.
So, what are some things that you miss about Venezuela? You know, Venezuela is one of those countries that most Americans have heard of it, but probably couldn't find it on a map or, couldn't really tell us too much about the country. First off, I'll ask you, what were some of the things that kind of shocked you when you got down there?
Yeah. So again, going back to that being American and living with such privilege, even though, you know, my family wasn't exceptionally wealthy, to go there and to see the abject poverty that exists in the world, which I had not been extensively exposed to before that experience. I mean, I had to get a passport to leave the country, and I was, 21? ish. So that was my first experience leaving the country. And yeah, that, you know, things aren't built around safety and human comfort. Grocery stores often didn't have all of the things that we see in a grocery store here. Shelves were much emptier. And even things that their country produces, you know, like sugar, we would go to the grocery store, you know, big grocery stores like we have here in the U.S., and shelves would be empty. They just wouldn't have those things. So all of those things were really surprising to me, and there are lots of ways that they live differently. You know, the culture is different than here. Not going anywhere in the evening, you know, being in your home by 7 o'clock p.m., especially for women, it wasn't safe to be out in the evenings. And I lived in a big city there, and here I live in the country, so yeah. Very different.
What were some of the things about Venezuela that you really maybe fell in love with or that you really miss now that you're back here? And, you know, I mean, this has been a long time since you studied there, but what are some of the things that you definitely, you know, you really loved about Venezuela or that you really miss?
Yeah, they really had to peel me away from Venezuela. I miss it all.
That's a great way of saying that. I love that image. They'd peel me away. That's
yes,
great.
Yes, kicking and screaming. The people are so warm and wonderful and welcoming and just happy and friendly. People there connect around dance, and so like music and dance is so inherently part of the culture. And, you know, you can sit around, you can visit, but that doesn't really connect you until you've danced with the people. Merengue, salsa, those are the two big ones. And then there's cultures that kind of sneak in from the countries surrounding the indigenous populations that live in South America as well. So it's just such a rich and beautiful and vibrant culture. The food, I'm not doing too bad with the food because I cook Venezuelan food in my house with my family a lot of the time. I miss their cheese. So, you know, you can't import cheese very easily, so you can't get the Venezuelan handmade cheese here. But there were cachapas, and they're made from sweet corn, so I can make cachapas anytime I want to out of our sweet corn that we grow here. But you can't layer it with that thick layer of homemade cheese. But yeah, unfortunately, you know, the situation in Venezuela is not great, and a lot of my friends who are close enough to be family have left or have died. I only know a few people still in country, and you know, that the exodus from Venezuela is not necessarily related to having the money to leave. It's life and death.
Yeah. That was awesome. I loved hearing those stories about your time down in South America. I have not yet got to South America. I hope at some point to eventually make my way down there. You're not the first person I talked to that had spent time down there. And almost everybody I've spoken to that has been in South America, whether it was Venezuela, Chile, Argentina, they all say the same thing about the people. The people are so warm and welcoming, and that's awesome. I hope someday to make it down there.
I've never met a Venezuelan I couldn't be friends with.
Okay, well, that's a strong statement. I can't say that about Americans or a lot of other places that I've been. Okay, so they peeled you away, and you came back to the United States, and you entered education, and you became a teacher. How many years did you end up teaching?
So all counted, I think it was 10 years? I can't remember now. Don't make me.
And you eventually made the decision. You eventually made the decision to leave that profession. What was there something that pushed you away from education? Because that's what's happening to a lot of teachers I know right now. With everything that we've gone through over the last 2 years, you know, people are leaving education. What was your? If you want to share, what made you say, you know, I'm gonna go in a different direction?
Yeah. I taught in a couple different circumstances, so I feel like I had a broad experience in education, hard enough to know what's out there. And I think, you know, most of all, it was burnout. I was giving my all to my students at school, and when you give your all in one place, you don't have it to give at home as well. And I actually decided to leave education when I got pregnant with my oldest. I had had some experiences there, wonderful experiences in education, but also enough that I knew that if I wanted to give everything I wanted to give to my family at home, I couldn't do that and keep teaching. And I did teach part-time for a semester after she was born, and it was at a different school, and so I really felt like, you know, this was nice, but this isn't what I want to do with my time and energy. And since then, I've spent a lot of time, you know, she's now turning 8 this coming weekend, so I've spent a lot of time thinking about how I invest myself, my time, my energy, my talent, what I move toward, what I move away from, and really listening to that voice inside that says, you know, this is where you should be, or this is not really where you should be.
Burnout is very real in education, 100%. But you didn't completely leave education. I really want to hear your take on this. And you told me not too long, and I didn't know this until we talked recently, but eventually you ran for school board, or you served on your local school board. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I encourage everyone to run for local government. I think it's so important to invest in your community in that way. And I remember growing up, my dad often served on the local borough council. I don't in particular remember him serving for a lot of government functions. Oh, the zoning hearing board. He was appointed to the zoning hearing board. And I would go along to meetings. And then, of course, with my education, I'm pretty familiar with government functions. But it was always of interest to me because I would go as a kid. I served on my borough council when I was 19, I think it was a 2-year term, and that was really eye-opening. And then I also, when my dad passed away, it left a vacancy on the zoning hearing board, and I wrote a letter. That is, that office is by appointment, and so I was appointed to the zoning hearing board. And then there's some changes happening in our community, and I was feeling like, I don't really know or understand this decision making that is happening at the school board level, and my kids were not old enough to be in school, but I really felt like I needed to invest some of my mental energy there to really learn what was going on. And I had a great experience on the school board, but it was also eye-opening. I learned a lot. I learned a lot because when you teach the functions of government, that's not always how the government works. And so learning it firsthand was very eye-opening. And, you know, we call it politics or whatever, but the administration of a school is very different from the administration of another municipality. And so my experience serving on borough council or understanding how local government functions did not help much when I was dipping my toes into the school board. I had a lot to learn there.
I don't know how it works in other states, but I am continually blown away with the fact that in Pennsylvania, you know, anybody can run for school board. And if you're elected, then you're put in, you know, in a very powerful position in the sense of that you are overseeing millions of dollars worth of a budget, hundreds of employees, and you can have zero background in education and poop, there you are. You know, you at least came in with the background of having taught in a school, understanding a little bit about, you know, what does it mean when a teacher is talking about curriculum, or what does it mean when we're talking about, you know, disciplining children. But when you look at the average school board, they're made up of, you know, men and women that the majority of them have no idea about what school is other than that they were a student at some point in their life. And yet we're like, here are the keys. Okay, drive the car. I just find that so odd. And also, you know, at times it can be, it can be dangerous, I think, because we can get people on there that have an agenda that necessarily doesn't, you know, fit the educational purposes of what the district's trying to approve or whatever. So I mean, personally, when we're talking about local government, I agree with you. I think more people, everyone should get involved some level locally, if not just going to meetings, you know, if not, you know, if running for something isn't, you know, for you, but sitting in on a borough council meeting and finding out what's going on in your community. Cause there's a lot of things that going on that you probably don't even realize are going on and that you might have a voice in. School board as well, you know, it's one of those thankless positions. They're not paid. And it's a lot of time. It's a huge time commitment for the people that serve it. So I kind of was just bashing school boards for a minute, but I do have to say, you know, the people that do it deserve pats on the back, because if they don't do it, you know, who will? So I just think the system could be reformed a little bit maybe. But was there an incident when you served on the school board where you were ever like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening? Or was there ever meetings where, you know, community members or parents came in and just yelled at you guys about stuff? I'm sure it happened, but could you share one or two anecdotes about that, your time on the board?
Sure. In the beginning, I don't think people, you know, like you said, there are 9 people elected to a school board, not all at once. You know, there's that changing of the guard, and only some of them are elected, like, so it's half and it's a 4-year term, so half of us came in and the other half were finishing their term from before. And so, you know, I think my name was out there in the community and a couple of people knew me, but I wouldn't say that the administration running the school really knew me very well at all. You know, assuming that I came in with no background, or maybe they knew I had been a teacher. But one of the things that happened early on was that the superintendent, who's no longer at that school, the superintendent was telling me how things were going to be. And I would come home, you know, with my eyebrows raised, like, I don't understand. I thought I was one of 9 people telling the superintendent how things would be. So there was a sharp learning curve for me and what was acceptable and what was not in terms of how those dialogues could go. So I do remember a couple moments of that, and finally for me coming to a point where I was not willing to hear some of those suggestions that he had. And then the superintendency changed close to the middle of my term. And the, you know, how business is done in a meeting, and I often said, you know, I'm only one of 9 people there, but I am one of 9 people, and I have a vote, and I'm going to use it. And how important, as you said, members of the public coming and making comments on agenda items or non-agenda items. And there were a couple of moments when there were board members that said negative things. Nasty things to members of the public. And I just, like, in my heart of hearts, I keep thinking, you know, it takes a lot to stand up. You know, board members, I've always respected board members. And so it takes a lot to come into a meeting as a member of the public and stand up and say what you're thinking or what's on your mind. And so why would we ever close off that voice or shut that down in some way? I think it's really hard for them to come in and say. So I really feel like there's a really important function of people, members of the public, you know, keeping board members and administrations accountable, you know, serving that watchdog function that we cannot lose. We cannot afford to lose that. Because as you said, you know, we're all coming at this with different perspectives, different life experience, and not necessarily experience in education. There is a tiny training at the beginning now mandated by the state of Pennsylvania, but, you know, it's inadequate to describe exactly what goes on. And so, you know, taking tours of the school, or if you're on, you know, the council of your local municipality, take tours of your town, walk around, make sure your phone number is available to people to call you. Have those face-to-face conversations. There's a lot of, also, I'll say, distrust Within the community, you know, people were afraid to email me because there would be a paper trail. But they would be willing to sit with me and talk with me because talking face-to-face felt more safe to them. And that was people working within the system. That was people that were simply community members, and they were afraid of repercussions if the email was captured in some way. Or even, you know, some of them wouldn't have phone conversations with me, but they would talk with me face-to-face. So building that trust in different ways is really important.
Well, there's one thing I also want to tell our listeners about, and that's we have shared friends, and you and so our friends that are shared, you worked with them on a team in an event called Sheep to Shawl. And for anyone outside of the of that community, that those are probably, you know, foreign, that this whole concept is pretty foreign. So I'd like you to tell the listeners briefly, what is a Sheep to Shawl team? Like, what do you do? And then we'll take the conversation a little bit farther from there.
Okay, yeah. So Sheep to Shawl is where you take a sheep and you shear it. Then you use the fleece to card it, spin it into yarn, and then use the yarn to weave a shawl in a very short amount of time. It's usually about 2.5 hours.
So this is okay, everybody. Did you hear that? So the state event takes place at the Pennsylvania Farm Show every January, and there's teams. There's usually like how many, Abby? Like eight, nine teams. Sometimes maybe more. I don't know.
Yeah, it started out in the early 2000s with just a few teams, like maybe four-ish. They weren't really filling the arena, and now they have to turn teams away because it's so popular. So they can fit, I think, 8 teams in that arena.
So you have this team of people and a live sheep, just so we're all clear. And one person's job is, as Abby said, to shear it. And this is all timed event. And as soon as it's been shorn, it automatically goes right to the next team member or team members that are doing all the things that Abby said, carding it. And if those are words that you don't know what they mean, look them up. Or you can watch video. I'll post a link in the show notes to the Sheep to Shawl competition. And then it just keeps the material just keeps getting past the next team member, and it gets spun on a spinning wheel and then right onto a loom, and they make a shawl. And it's what's really crazy is what is the time limit? I forget, Abby.
I want to say it's 2.5 hours. So, you know, the goal is to do it in less than that. And if you don't reach the time limit, then you're disqualified.
So do you hear this, people? You got a live sheep. You're starting with that, and you have to have a finished shawl in 2 hours' time. I think it's such a crazy concept, but when you watch these teams work, it's true teamwork. I mean, maybe behind the scenes some people might be cockier than others on the team or something like that, but I think for the most part they're so focused on getting, you know, my part is at the spinning wheel and I need to get spinning so I can get this yarn made, and then the person on the loom, like, I'm on the loom, I gotta weave this as fast as I can. How did you ever get involved in that?
Oh, what a great question. I'm so glad you asked. So when I was a kid, my mom was very creative and very into different crafts and learning old and sometimes forgotten crafts. And so I remember going with her. I think I was in third or fourth grade, and we went to a spinning class or a spinning meeting. And one of the ladies there took me under her wing, and she said, here, you can try my spinning wheel. And she was so encouraging from the start. She was like, oh, look at this. You're a natural. You're so good at this. And that early, you know, encouragement is what got me spinning. I started spinning at age 10. And so I tease everybody around me that I've been spinning longer than they have, or double the time they have, or, you know, as I've taught students how to spin and weave, I've been saying, you know, I've been doing this longer than you've been alive. And it was funnier when I was younger. So as I age, it's probably not as funny. But yeah. And so then I started volunteering annually at our Heritage Days event, the Warrior Run Fort Freeland Heritage Days. And I learned flax culture. So how to grow and process flax into linen. And in the Pennsylvania German tradition. And so that has always been a really integral part of my life as well. I started volunteering at Heritage Days before I learned to spin. Then I kind of moved into that as I was learning to spin. So I can spin a number of different fibers in the wool, flax into linen, silk. I've tried all kinds of things, milkweed, dog hair. I've tried all of the things, but settled on, I really prefer wool or flax.
The next time we're together in person, there's a famous old traditional German folk song about a girl that spins. And it's one of my favorite songs. It's really pretty melodies. The next time you're at our house, I'll sing that for you because it's all about this girl spinning. And it's every time you talk about that, that's the only thing that's in my mind is this song that I know so well.
I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it's crazy. The first time I saw you guys on TV at the farm show competing in this, I just couldn't get over the fact that you were literally one end of the team was a live animal and the other team was coming out. You know, the other end of the team was coming out this finished shawl. Unbelievable. And I'm so glad that you guys are, maintaining these old traditions like flax. Flax is coming back. I have other friends that are in the fiber industry or, that mess around with fibers. And they've been saying a lot that, a lot more people are starting to do things with flax, which was this, colonial era. Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Dutch particularly, were good at using flax and, like you said, spinning it. And here's a plant and not an animal. So I'm glad that you're continuing these traditions and keeping them alive, and passing them on to future generations.
Absolutely. My kids already know how to spin and they have already grown flax. And of course, we have the sheep now. So
it's awesome. Well, it's one last thing I want to say, Abby. So you did mention earlier in the interview that you and your husband recently bought the farm. And I know that in English we use that phrase usually to mean that somebody kicked the bucket, but you guys literally bought your family farm. I have to ask this question. I hope it's not too personal. How difficult of a decision was that? Because that is, buying a farm is, okay, financially, there's a huge risk. And it's expensive, farmland, land is worth a lot of money. So when you and your husband had that discussion, was that a hard discussion or was it one that was like, this is something we have to do? The end of story. What was that like for you guys?
Yeah, I would say the discussion between my husband and I came about very organically, and it was something we were definitely interested in. We didn't have a clear timeline or how the process worked. And so that actually started probably 8 or 10 years ago. And so this is not a short timeline by any means. And I remember going to classes with my parents to, figure out a way to transition the farm. And we'll call it transition because it is really darn near impossible for young people to purchase a farm. My family farm is a little over 300 acres, 200 tillable, and so with 200 acres of working land, that's incredibly expensive, and someone my age would typically not be able to afford that, except that my parents were trying to find a way to make it feasible for my husband and I to purchase. And, the other part of that is that, normally the small farm, I'll call it a small farm, it's usually under 250 acres tillable, or I think it's actually $250,000 earned income is considered small farms across the nation. But anyway, typically on a small farm, I don't know where I was going with that, Doug.
Well, how hard was the decision? But you made it sound like the decision was pretty easy to make. This is something we're going to do. And you had the luck that your parents were, wanted to pass this on to you guys or at least make it possible for you to take over the farm. What challenges as a young couple with young children have you run into being young farmers, younger farmers, I guess we could say?
Yeah. So one of the bigger challenges to the whole transition plan was my dad died partway through the process, and so we really lost a wealth of information, not just a friend and father, but that information is gone now.
Yeah.
And so if we didn't learn it while he was alive, like how to take care of the equipment or the animals, my husband is very talented in taking care of animals, so we less worry about that and more about the equipment. Where to get things, where to find things, or how things are supposed to work, or how the equipment is supposed to sound when it runs, or how often you maintenance certain parts of the equipment. All of that is gone. And so that has probably been our biggest challenge. We are very lucky to have a lot of local resources who operate farms similar to ours. And so we have been able to ask them questions. And there's a sense of competitiveness in the farming community, except when you really need help, your neighbors are there for you. And so we've really benefited from, you know, having others around the community that have been willing to answer our questions.
Yeah, I think there's no better team player than farmers when it comes to other farmers in need. Absolutely. We experienced that firsthand on our family farm and still do. You know, I'll talk to my dad on the phone. He'll be like, oh, neighbor down the road, farmer down the road was over helping me do this weekend, and I'm going to help him do this next weekend. And it's truly it's almost like a fraternity to a certain extent, the farm family in a greater sense. Abby, we end all of our interviews on this show with 10 quick questions. Are you ready for
sure.
your 10 quick questions? All right, okay. They're easy. Here we go. Number one, what is your morning drink of choice?
Water.
Water. Are you a coffee drinker or not?
Sometimes, yes, but it's not like it was in Venezuela.
So. I was going to say, Venezuela had to be a huge coffee culture. My goodness.
Yeah. It's not the thing here.
It's fair. Okay. Water's good and clean, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, number two. Who is a go-to musical artist or group for you?
Oh my gosh, I don't even know. All things bluegrass. I mostly listen to bluegrass or Latin music.
Okay. What a great mix, right? So if we could come up with a Latin bluegrass band or a bluegrass Latin band.
Yeah. There's similarities. You'd be
surprised. There are. You're right. Number three. What is a movie that you can watch over and over again and it never gets old?
Oh, I don't watch a lot of movies, Doug.
Well, think back to your childhood, maybe one that from your youth.
Last of the Mohicans. I'll pick that one.
Oh, that's a great film. No, that's a great film. Great film. Number four, what is the last thing that you read?
I read a book about life on the Pennsylvania frontier and the go-betweens, the interpreters that were both indigenous individuals and European individuals who were kind of being the interpreters between both cultures.
So imagine then Conrad Weiser was listed in that book. He had to have been. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Send me the name of that book because I'd read that if I didn't already read it. I don't know. I have books about the Pennsylvania frontier, but that one sounds great. Especially if it talks a little bit more about the native perspective, because that often lacks in a lot of stuff. Cool. That'd be really neat. All right. Number five. What's your favorite pizza topping?
Bacon.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Six. Laying on the beach or going for a hike?
Probably a hike. That's a lot more accessible to me here.
Yeah. Can't go lay on the shores of the Susquehanna down there in Danville?
No, thank
Come
you.
On.
No, thank you.
All right. Number seven. You have invited me over for dinner. What are you making?
Arepas.
Oh, explain. What's that?
So it's like a kind of like a sandwich, but the bread part is made out of masa, cornmeal, and then it's stuffed with some shredded beef, and then on the side there's some black beans and maybe some platanos. It's gonna be good.
I'll be down right away. That sounds delicious. Number eight, what is a dream vacation destination of yours?
I'd go back to Venezuela in a heartbeat. They have everything. They have beautiful beaches. They have mountains. They have desert. They have waterfalls. So that's where I'm going for vacation.
Okay. Sounds good. Number nine, what's something you're afraid of?
Something that I worry about is that my husband will die before I do.
Oof.
I'm afraid of losing people that I love.
Yeah.
That separation.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to talk about that. You're right, though. Boy, that's a good one. Last question. What job, other than one that you've had, would you love to have?
Ooh, I'd love to make quilts or, like, design quilts for people. I love quilting.
I could absolutely see you doing that. Abby, it has been an absolute joy having you on the show. It's great being able to reconnect, and we talked about some things that I've often wanted to ask you about and just never had the opportunity. So I thank you for sharing your stories and coming up on the front porch today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Doug. It's been great.
All right, we'll talk soon.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Doug's Front Porch, a conversational podcast with your host, Doug Maidenford. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. 5 stars only, please. Follow along on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just look for Doug's Front Porch. Also, please feel free to tell all of your friends about the show, and I'll see you all next time on my front porch.